evening. I'm David Schoenbrunn. We're gathered together tonight to hear an extraordinary story. One of the most fascinating stories in the history of man. Whether it is true or false is something that you will judge after you've heard the story and a discussion of it by a panel of scientists and science editors. The story will be told by the two people who have lived it. First, Mr. Barney Hill and his wife, Betty Hill. Barney and Betty Hill are two of many Americans who claim to have seen an unidentified flying object, and two of perhaps 100 who claim to have been aboard a flying saucer. Their story was written up for them by John Fuller, author, columnist, who in this new book, The Interrupted Journey, Two Lost Hours Aboard a Flying Saucer, tells not only their story, but their therapy and the revelation to themselves, by themselves, under hypnosis, of their extraordinary experience. And this will then be examined and discussed by a panel of experts. Let's now meet our experts. Dr. Leo Sprinkle, counselor and assistant professor of psychology at the University of Wyoming. Mr. Edward Edelson, science editor of the World Journal Tribune of New York. Professor James McDonald, an atmospheric physics professor at the University of Arizona. Mr. Leon Jaraff, science editor of Time magazine. And Carl Sagan, professor at Harvard University and also at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory. Now, Mr. and Mrs. Hill, for your story. I believe it began on the night of the 19th of September, 1961, as you were driving home from a vacation in Canada, and something happened near Lancaster, New Hampshire. Which one of you was the first to see this something happen?
Betty was the first one.
Yes.
Betty, could you start the story then?
Yes. We were driving along on Route 3, and it was a very clear night, and the moon was very almost full and very bright, and the sky was very clear, and we could see the stars easily. When suddenly, right near the moon, I noticed a new star, which was much larger and brighter than the other stars in the sky. And I called Barney's attention to this. And then suddenly, we noticed it started to move. And it went across the face of the moon. We stopped the car and got out to look at this because we thought it was a satellite. And while we were observing it, it made a turn and started to come in our direction. And at this point, we changed our minds, thinking that it must be a plane. We were driving along, and as it came in closer, I began to realize that it was not a satellite or a plane, that it was something that I had never seen before. Now, this was based on its maneuverability, the way it was flying. It was had a very erratic flight in the sky, and as it came in closer to us, it was sort of riding along on the ridge of the mountains. And then when we got in the area of Indian Head, it suddenly swung out over the highway in front of our car. At this time, I could see a row of windows around the edge and a red light on each side. And it was at this point that Barney stopped the car, and he decided to get out to get a good look at it and to identify it.
So I got out of the car and took the pair of binoculars, 7x50 crescent of binoculars, and stepped away. And as I raised the binoculars, looking over the roof of the car from my position on the ground, the object shifted across the highway, where it now, in making the shift, it also had a descent motion that brought it to what I roughly estimated as about 100 feet in the air. And then I began walking across the highway into the field. I walked quite a distance in the field, and I saw what I thought were figures standing by this huge plate glass looking back at me. I couldn't believe it. I dashed back to the car screaming to Betty that, oh my gosh, I said, it's going to capture us, is what I said. There was a series of beeps, and then later there was another series of beeps. And Betty asked me if I now believed in flying saucers, and I told her, don't be ridiculous, of course not. We continued then to proceed on to Portsmouth, and we arrived. We both felt very uncomfortable and clean. I don't think I mentioned to Betty how I felt, but I felt clammy, as if I had fallen into something very, very filthy.
What time did you come home? I understand there was a time factor that you were surprised that you had come home so late.
Well, actually, at the time, no, I wasn't surprised that we had arrived home later than really what we would have expected, because we didn't put any particular importance on our arrival time, except that we knew it was around 4:30. We should have arrived home at 4 hours. We arrived home in about 5.5 to 6 hours.
What were these objects on the back of your car that bothered you so much?
Well, when we went, when I went out to look at the car, to check it with the compass, as this physicist had suggested, I found some round, highly polished spots on the trunk of the car. When I put the compass near them, it just reacted erratically.
And spun around?
Yes. And then when I moved it away, the compass reacted normally.
We had been asked if others had seen these spots, and there are. There was a sergeant living in our apartment building at the time. He and his wife, they knew we had been on vacation, so they came down, and Betty told them she had gone out, and she was quite upset about what she had seen and was trying to get me to go out, and I wouldn't. So they went out and took a look, and they came in quite excited, insisting that I go out and look on the trunk of Betty's car. So when I went out, I also, too, saw these large, shiny spots. And I didn't put any, it wasn't important. They were just shiny spots. I didn't know how they got there, but I didn't try to even understand how they were there.
What next?
During the same period of time, well, about 10 days after the sighting itself, I had a series of dreams that lasted for about 5 nights. And these were somewhat upsetting and puzzling to me. At first, I thought of them only as bad dreams. But then when the scientists noticed that there was this period of time, then I began to wonder if my dreams might have been my way of trying to recall what had happened.
What could you tell us now about what was in those dreams?
Well, the dreams, well, briefly, in my dreams, we were driving along, we were stopped by a group of men on the highway, taken out of the car, taken aboard the UFO, underwent physical examination, and then were released. These were the dreams that I had.
How long after your mysterious experience in Lancaster in the mountains did you go to see Dr. Simon?
Well, this would have been in the latter part of 1963. The sighting was in September 1961. Mm-hmm. And so I was...
More than 2 years,
yes.
Revealed to you. What story did you learn about your experience under hypnosis?
Well, there were the beeping sounds. And then I apparently went into some kind of a daze, some kind of condition like this. And we're driving along, and Barney suddenly made a sharp left-hand turn off the highway, and we went around a curve, and there was a group of men standing in the highway. And under hypnosis, my first thought was, there must be an automobile accident. And then the car motor died, and Barney was trying to start the car, and he wasn't able to, and these men were coming closer, and they divided, and at this moment, I panicked. I became very frightened. I tried to open the car door, thinking I would get out, run, and hide in the woods until they were gone. And just as I opened the door, they stepped over where I was.
And could you remember under hypnosis what these men looked like?
Not at that moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
Then they took me out of the car, and I went into sort of another deeper daze of some sort.
Kind of a trance.
Yes. And then I was... more or less pulled myself out of this, or at least partially. And I found myself walking in the woods with a man on each side of me, and some in front, some behind me. And then in back of me was Barney, and he was like sleepwalking. And there were these two men holding, more or less holding him up. We walked through this long path in the woods until we came to the craft that was sitting on the ground. We went up the ramp, and...
I might add, the ramp was never mentioned in Betty's dreams, but both seemed to share the idea that we had been going up a ramp.
It was not in Betty's dreams,
no.
But it was the word that came out under hypnosis.
Yes, that's correct.
Yes. So we went up the ramp into this corridor that curved, and they took me into the first room, And they took Barney into the second room. And while I was in there, they did what we call a fairly simple physical examination.
Could you describe?
The first thing they did was they examined my arm. Apparently, they were looking at my skin. And they seemed to be making a lot of comments among themselves, as if they were quite excited about this. And they brought over what I called, I've never seen one, so I don't know, but I called it a microscope with a camera attached. Then after that, they took hair samples and on my fingernails. They checked my eyes, hair, my ears, nose, and things like this. And they looked over my hands and my feet, particularly my feet, quite thoroughly. Then they said they were going to test my nervous system. And they brought over some kind of a machine, which they touched.
Were you fully dressed?
No. They took off my dress and my shoes. And then during this, what they call the checking of my nervous system, I had a slip on. And they pulled my slip up and did this testing. And then the next one was the examiner had a needle. And I became aware that he was going to...
jab you?
Yes, I didn't know if it was an injection or what it was. And I begged him not to use the needle because it would hurt. And he started to insert it into my navel.
A long needle?
It was a long needle.
How
I don't
long?
Know how...
This long?
It was, I think under hypnosis, I'd say 4 to 6 inches.
Mm-hmm.
But I became badly frightened when I saw the needle. And then when I found a plan to put it into my navel, I became very frightened. And I begged them not to do it. And the leader said it wouldn't hurt. And they started to put it in, and it did.
Why were they doing it?
Well, he said it was a pregnancy test. And I said, well, it was no pregnancy test here. And when they seemed to be very surprised that I had any pain from this. And the leader put his hand up over my eyes, and the pain went away, but they stopped the test.
There was one man whom you called the leader?
There was one I called the leader and one I called the examiner.
What language did you speak to the man?
I spoke in English. And I don't know what language they spoke in, but I understood them in English.
By word or sound or thought transference? Or...
I don't know.
You don't know?
No, but... under hypnosis, it seemed to me I actually heard sounds.
And what happened,
I cannot say it was English.
What happened when the examination was finished?
Well, then I was standing there waiting to go back to the car because all during this time they reassured us that as soon as the tests were over, we'd go back to the car. And so I was standing there waiting, and they said that Barney's examination was taking longer and that I would have to wait for him. And then there was all this excitement. And this man came into the room and started tugging at my teeth. And I questioned them about this. And this is when they showed their surprise that Barney's teeth were removable and mine were not.
What were your experiences while Betty was in the room being examined by these man-like beings?
And I'd like to emphasize before I go into that is that this was brought out under hypnosis because I am still a bit reluctant in this area.
And I think it is important to reemphasize that the story you've just told is one that you were not consciously aware of,
never had
but before. Which was drawn out of you by your psychiatrist, Dr. Ben Simon,
under
hypnosis.
Yes. Yeah. And it seemed as if I was carried up the ramp. My feet were banging against the ground as these small men I described came up to me and carried me from the car and through the woods and up this ramp and into this room where I opened my eyes. I saw a table. Betty described the table as being adequate for her to lie on, the room where she was in. And at this time, I do not know where Betty is. And apparently, I am more concerned for my own welfare to be concerned about Betty. But the table that I described was small, and obviously the difference in our heights could be the answer.
Well, how tall were these men?
I estimate, I said they were about as tall as Betty, but this would mean that
they
would
be 5'1"?
About 4.5 to 5 feet.
I'm 5 feet.
5 feet.
Yes, and I'm 5'8". Mm-hmm. So that the 3 inches difference was quite a difference. And I said that the table was too small. Where I, too, was given an examination, I'm very conscious about my teeth. I was very upset about... I only got as far as saying something went into my mouth, and I did not bother to tell the doctor, and he did not press this as to what was happening, but I can only think now that this would have been when my teeth would have been extracted. And
Pulled out.
Yeah, I should have said pulled out because they're dentures. Yes, and so they weren't extracted. They had been. But if I go on the point, explain that the kind of examination that I had been given is a scraping of the skin, and I had been turned over. They were interested in body openings, and a cup-like object was placed against my genitals. And I was reluctant to talk about that until Mr. Fuller was able to word it for me by saying lower abdomen. And this would have been the extent of the examination.
What do you believe now, Bunny?
Oh, I ask Betty first.
All right, Betty.
I believe we were really captured. I mean, if we were not captured, we were still faced with the problem of what happened during this 2 hours of amnesia.
Bunny?
Well, this is what I'm forced, in a sense, to believe, that something happened that night. I can't say definite as to what definitely happened, but apparently if the hypnosis, which we were led to believe would be the means of opening up the amnesia, if this is not the facts, then what are the facts?
I think we're going to discuss that with a group of very knowledgeable people in just a moment from now. We're back with Barney and Betty Hill and about to begin discussion of their extraordinary case. But before we go to the panel, I think we ought to look at some sketches that they made. You may remember they said that when they got home from their experience, they both drew sketches of what they had seen, and then later, under hypnosis, they drew more sketches. Could you identify these and tell us what they are?
This is one that Barney drew of the abduction spot itself.
Abduction took place.
Yes, this is how he remembered this.
A car, a roadblock, and the disc.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
This is one that Betty drew, and similar to the one I drew, and the two red balls on the side of the indicate the red lights.
That's what you saw that night.
This you drew that night. Night. Yes. Now the next picture is what I tried to describe when I was standing in the field, and as the lights had parted away from the craft itself, and the figure standing there looking back at me. Now the next sketch is one I sketched while under hypnosis. And I was trying to explain to Dr. Simon what persons that I was involved with looked like, and this is what I drew in deep trance. I was trying to emphasize the eyes, and this is what was so outstanding, that the eyes seemed to go around the side of the face this way. And the cap was my attempt at drawing a military cap.
Mm-hmm. They had a military cap and some sort of a scarf scribbled around the neck?
Yes.
The figure doesn't seem to have a mouth.
No, it doesn't. This is a map that Betty drew. And you care to briefly tell about that, Betty?
On board the craft, I asked them where they came from. And the leader went over and showed me this map. He didn't explain where he was on the map, but he did explain that the lines, he called them trade routes, and places where they went regularly, and then expeditions.
Now, this is another map that we have here that shows the constellation of Pegasus?
Yes. This was printed in the New York Times 1 year after Betty had drawn her map, in which the Russians was reporting that they thought the radio signals were emanating from this section in the sky. She then compared the sketch she had drawn with the map that was published in the New York Times, and she thought that there was a great similarity between the two.
Now, what is this coming up? Now, that seems to be another attempt to sketch these humanoid creatures.
Yeah, that's correct. This was after I had undergone the session of regressive hypnosis and now trying to draw, for the doctor's benefit, what I thought the creatures looked like. And again, there's the heavy emphasis on the eyes, the two slits representing nostrils, and my attempt to show the slit line for the mouth, and when the mouth was parted, that is what I'm trying to show in this sketch. There was what I thought was a membrane inside that seemed to flutter.
Rather than the same lip muscles that we have.
That we have, yes.
And the two nostrils without a nose.
Yes, that's correct.
All right, I think that the panel has been very patient, I'm sure very interested in everything that's been said.
And perhaps we might ask, who would like to start the questioning? Dr. Sagan of Harvard University, and I think also of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory at Harvard. All right, Dr. Sagan.
Well, I'd like to begin the questioning, if I may, with one general line of inquiry. Our present understanding of the evolution of life on Earth is that it's a slow process of evolution by natural selection, that human beings are the product of several billions of years of random mutation, accidental effects, leading up to what we are now. If events were even slightly different in the previous history of the Earth, we think that we would not wind up with things that are closely human beings, but with something else. Now, other planets certainly have environments quite different from those on the Earth, and therefore we would expect that beings that evolved there would have even greater differences and would not look closely like human beings. And that's why I was interested to see that the characterization of the inhabitants of this supposed extraterrestrial space vehicle were, with a few minor differences, very closely human. Head, two eyes, something like a nose, mouth, hands, feet, and so on. And this seemed to me to have an intrinsic implausibility about it. It seemed to me that much more likely that this was projecting human experience onto perhaps something else. The one question I'd like to ask is fingers. How many fingers?
Dr. Sagan.
Didn't notice any fingers. How about earlobes?
I didn't notice ears.
How about Mrs.
May I just briefly inject something here? We were on another discussion, and after very quietly, more or less, very relaxed, discussing for about 2.5 hours, the scientists questioned us very closely about the absence of our seeing or noticing hands. So the announcer put a paper over my hand and asked the scientist, what about my hands? Had he noticed anything? Was I wearing a ring or not? And he had to admit he hadn't noticed them. And this would have been a much more relaxed situation.
Right. Well, but the point is that you did notice some details, and I was interested in whether you had noticed some other details.
Yes. No, I had not.
How about hair?
Betty?
No, I didn't.
Yes?
I think the thing that strikes me most is the fact that not only did these creatures breathe the Earth's atmosphere with no difficulty, but you were able to breathe the spacecraft's atmosphere with no difficulty.
Is that a question?
No, it's our comment.
Well, that's all I can say.
Did you notice any respirators or anything of that sort?
Not from my position, no.
Leon Jaref, of the science editor of Time magazine, I think, has a question or comment.
Yes, as I understand it, the only tangible evidence of the visit of this ship and their experience with it is the appearance of the bright, shiny spots on the trunk of your car. Is that correct?
That would have been one of the tangible evidence. One that I hadn't found to be important is that when I arrived in Portsmouth that morning, my shoes were badly scuffed. And this, well, it's my opinion, or rather my word, there's no proof to it.
The reason I ask, I am aware of the scuff marks on your shoes, but
yes,
that could have happened in any earthly experience.
This is correct.
The point that I wonder about is the failure either of Mrs. Hill to call the attention of these spots to Mr. Webb of the Hayden Planetarium, who was there a couple of days later, perhaps you had mentioned them, but then Mr. Webb neglected to look at them. And since this is the only tangible evidence, we wonder why someone didn't think of this.
We discussed the spots with Walter Webb and with Mr. Holman and Mr. Jackson. But we had spent hours discussing this. And then it was just an oversight on their part in leaving when they left us. We just forgot to show them to him.
Did you put that question to Mr. Webb? Maybe John, who was talking.
Yes, I did. And Walter Webb simply throws up his hand and disgusted at his own failure as an investigator. I am convinced in my own mind that nothing was hidden, that it was simply a very serious oversight, and he agrees that it was.
Ed Edelson of World Journal Tribune.
Are those spots still there? And if not, what happened to them?
The spots gradually wore away over the winter months, and we don't have the car now.
Professor McDonald of the University of Arizona.
Well, while we're on the spots, there is a point that probably ought to be made and then a question that ought to be asked. The reason you originally got the compass out to look at those was that someone had suggested that this would be a means of testing for radiation. It's not clear to me how that would ever have detected the irradiation of the car. I think that is just an observation that should be made.
Are you saying that if it were irradiated, that the compass would not in any case behave this way?
Yeah, in the first instance, I'm saying that irradiation could not be detected with an automatic compass, but so that's just a side comment. But you did the experiment nevertheless, and so we have the results of the experiment, and it's quite disconcerting because with anything other than a current rapidly changing dipole moment of some mysterious kind in the trunk of the car, there is no easy way to understand the mechanism to cause the compass needle to spin.
Were those beeping sounds the only noise you heard as this apparently huge aircraft approached?
Yes, this was the only sound we heard. And Bonnie, you didn't hear any sound when you were out in the field.
No, I didn't hear any sound. But it wasn't as the aircraft approached. It was after I had dashed back to the car and screamed to Betty that something was going to capture us. Then there was a series of beeps. Now, I do recall touching the steering column because there was a very subtle vibration. And the last I remembered is Betty was feeling around on the panel of the car, the dashboard itself. And then later there was another series of beeps, and again we remarked, "What's that?" And Betty then asked if I believed in flying saucers, and I said no.
I'm certainly not a psychologist, but some aspects of the story that Mrs. Hill told, particularly the needle incident, seemed to me recognizable from having read Freud. And I wonder, Mr. Schönbrunn, if that by any chance had been talked over between you and Dr. Simon. And
yes, I would rather not put that into context, but it has been. However, I think that Mr. Fuller had discussed that with Dr. Simon.
Well, I discussed it with Betty herself, too, and Betty, as a qualified state social worker, is aware of the dream symbolism and that sort of thing. And it is something that she cannot explain one way or the other. I don't think that it should be discussed publicly. I do say that that facet of it has been completely and thoroughly explored, and Betty is fully aware of it as anybody else.
Mm-hmm. May I add something? Sure. There's something that I've discovered since the hypnosis, and I don't know if this would apply to adults, but in hospitals, when it's necessary to obtain a blood sample from a small infant, it is done through the navel.
I think that you might correct me if this is wrong, at least point out to one fact, that you said it was a very large needle, larger than anything that you had ever seen before.
It was a long needle.
That it had been plunged into your navel.
I can't say it was plunged in,
but
they started to insert it, and I had pain. And I was under the impression they stopped.
But there was no blood or physical evidence of puncture.
I wasn't aware of this until 1964.
Well, whenever it happened, if it did happen, you didn't detect any wound on your body?
No.
Any other questions about this? Well, I think that I'd like to be very careful about this, and I've taken very careful notes in my discussion with Dr. Simon. And I'd like to read these notes to you. I want to take just a second to go over them myself, and we will be back with Dr. Simon's testimony given to us right after this message. I recently had the opportunity of talking to Dr. Ben Simon, the psychiatrist who has treated Betty and Barney Hill, and asked him whether he could summarize for me his findings. He made it very clear that we must avoid such words as belief or other unscientific words, and that the treatment has not been completely concluded. And so this is a summary of the doctor's thoughts on the case of Barney and Betty Hill. He said that from the very start he envisaged four possibilities. One is that it might be a rare psychological phenomenon known as folie à deux. That means both people going crazy at the same time with the same illusion. And he excluded that immediately. He said these were to him very, very sane and reasonable and honest people and not suffering from this quite rare psychological phenomenon of folie à deux. The second possibility is that this was simply a fraud. And he said, of course, he had to go into that. And he went into it very thoroughly. And he is convinced that the way their stories came out in hypnosis, as well as the waking period analysis,
convinces him that there is no case for fraud here at all. Then there was the third possibility, that the story was fundamentally true, as related, that in fact they not only sighted a flying object, but that they were aboard a flying object, a flying saucer, and met humanoid creatures. And he said that after examination, he came to the conclusion that this was a very remote possibility. And he said there were any number of evidences that pointed in another direction, which leads to the fourth possibility in his various hypotheses, which he calls the dream hypothesis. And that is that Betty, after the experience, had certain dreams, and that after a period of time, the dreams became reality. And the doctor pointed out that although under hypnosis, the patient always tells the truth, it is the truth as the patient sees and knows the truth himself, but it is not necessarily the ultimate non-personal truth. And the doctor said he found many evidences that there was a strong stimulus from the very first experience that you had inciting this object, a very strong stimulus towards believing the existence of the flying saucer. And the doctor said to me, I do believe that they saw an unidentified flying object. And his final word on the subject is that there is very strong evidence of dream content, and that of all of the hypotheses that he examined, the dream hypothesis is the most likely one, and that is the burden of his present summary. Before we go on to discuss the very much broader subject, in which, of course, I think we're all interested, about the existence of intelligence creatures outside of Earth who have, in fact, an advanced technology and have been visiting Earth, before we go into that, I think in all fairness, I must allow John Fuller of the Hills to make some comment on the summary of what Dr. Ben Simon told me.
The only comment I can make is this, that I spent weeks with Dr. Simon going over the tapes, listening, stopping, going, all that sort of thing. Naturally, it's a long, hard pull in this kind of situation, and there are many vacillations and many hesitations and many different points of discussion that come up. One of the main reasons why Dr. Simon had moved away from the fact of the actuality of this is because of the fact that he, of course, was not interested in the UFO story. And as a scientist, and I don't blame him, he would be inclined, because it is not documented anywhere in scientific history. And this is the main reason why I think it is most important that the scientific fraternity turn toward the masses of the other cases which are appearing right now, so that if a case like this comes up, there is at least some background and some foundation, some substance to make a judgment one way or the other on this.
There's no doubt that there are a fair, small fraction of these sightings which remain unknown. That is very different from saying that the only possible explanation of these unknowns is that they're space vehicles from another planet. And if you look at the number of relatively obscure natural phenomena which have been identified, misapprehended as flying saucers, you see that nature is very complicated.
And I wonder if
it very well be that there are things in the atmosphere of the Earth, things of a biological nature, things in particular involving atmospheric refraction, which can explain the category of unknowns. The mere fact that we don't know it means just that. It doesn't mean that an extraterrestrial visitation is the only possible explanation.
I'd just like to point out that if these are visitors from another planet, they're going about this in a very illogical, let's say, unearthly way.
Well, that's logical.
Now, as Dr. Sagan has pointed out, the unidentifieds come in various different shapes, so apparently they've sent a whole fleet of these things here. They have gone to very great expense to come long distances, and yet somehow they don't want to open contact with us. They seem to delight in deserted places and in hard maneuvers. And I think one point Dr. Sagan mentioned in his book is that astronomers have been pointing telescopes toward the sky and taking pictures, many pictures, of the night sky, and there has been a singular lack of provable UFOs on those pictures.
Even when, I might add, these sky surveys have been designed to look for rapidly moving objects, namely the study of meteors. Now, and I think this tends to explain the general skepticism of the astronomical community towards the flying saucer reports in general. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't things up there that are unidentified, but let me reiterate again that unidentified doesn't mean extraterrestrial. It means we don't understand it. And I quite agree that that there's something there to be found out. I think there's probably things meteorological, things geophysical, and almost certainly things psychological.
Well, let me point out something there, and to go back both to the Hills case and to your remarks, Dr. Sagan. You suggest that a very small fraction of all the official cases, Project Blue Book of the Air Force, are unidentified. I've spent almost all the summer, a good bit of the spring, about the last 6 months, in nearly full-time study of this whole problem, and in, as part of that, been up to Wright-Patterson. Can't agree with either your remarks or the Air Force remarks, Project Blue Book figures. When I went over case after case, and I dare say I've looked into about 150, 200 cases at Wright-Patterson alone, the discrepancies between the official categorizations, balloons, aircraft, birds, and so on, astronomical, meteorological, the discrepancies between the official categorizations and the content of the reports was, to me, and no other word could describe this, astounding.
Dr. McDonough, despite these discrepancies that you found in the reports, have you or has anyone else who has investigated this phenomenon seriously ever found a single piece of evidence?
Hardware?
Hardware.
Not to my knowledge.
Anything other than pictures or sightings?
Not hardware. Certainly there have been many cases. I could probably sit here and think of a couple of dozen of instances where credible observers describe such artifacts, if you will, as indentations in the ground where a craft settled, scorched vegetation near which it was observed.
But then has there been a scientific inquiry?
Yes, there's been one case in which some people have agreed to the findings and some people have been skeptical. This is reported in the book by Coral Lorenzen. She and her husband, L.J. Lorenzen, are head of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, and they received a report from Dr. Fontes, who is a physician in Brazil, and the report describes fragments which supposedly came from a flying saucer which burst and then were analyzed. I can't comment on the report, how well it was done, but according to the conclusion, this would suggest it was of high-quality aluminum. Or magnesium, pardon me, higher quality than supposedly is possible in Earth laboratory. But there are other people who...
Gentlemen, please forgive me for interrupting this very exciting discussion at this moment. We'll come back to it right after this message. We're back again with Professor McDonald, a professor of atmospheric physics at the University of Arizona. Sir, you said a moment ago that the subject requires considerable examination, rectification. Would you begin by telling us of how you first got interested and came to this opinion?
Well, I've had a mild interest in this problem for perhaps a decade. My field is atmospheric physics, and a lot of the official explanations have centered around atmospheric physical phenomena, optical effects, and so on. And this led me, 1954 or so, to begin checking cases in the southern Arizona area where I live and work. Let me take one case. This is now almost 10 years ago, a rather important case. Many listeners will remember when it was headline news. It occurred in Levelland, Texas, the night of November 2nd and the morning of the 3rd, 1957. It involved some very interesting phenomena. I've interviewed some of the people who were involved in it. I have a map here that will give us a little bit of a notion of the general geography. Here is Levelland, Texas, a small town of about 30,000. The lines are highways running in and out of Levelland. From about 11 o'clock at night on the 2nd till around 1 in the morning on the 3rd, a series of about 10 independent sightings by 10 persons. A couple of them were law enforcement officers. Others were just drivers. Over here, there were two grain combines involved. In every one of these instances, the interesting thing that happened was that the driver of the vehicle suddenly came upon a very large, and when I say large, the reported sizes were of the order of 100 to 200 feet diameter, glowing, sometimes reddish, sometimes bluish objects hovering over fields or roads. The first effect on the vehicle was a interference with the lights, and then the ignition system failed.
Excuse me, Doctor. I noticed that you have a lot of numbers on the map. If you could point them out, these places where the sightings were made.
Yes. There are 10 numbers on here. I won't bother to mention the names of the individuals, but this 10 miles is about the size of this pencil, just to give you some scale. And these are spread over a two-hour period, and each one of these numbers, here's 1, 7, they correspond to the names of the people, were instances in which cars were stopped. And the lights went out. Now, as soon as the object took off, which is the characteristic pattern, some of the cars are stopped for two or three minutes, but then the objects rose from the ground, sometimes with enormous accelerations. Then the lights came back on without any manipulation of the ignition key, and the driver found he could immediately start his car. This was common to all of these cases. Now, the official explanation of this Level in Texas case, based on the Air Force handling of the Project Blue Book investigation, was that this was ball lightning. That's what accounted supposedly for these 200-foot diameter objects, plus wet ignitions, and that was the official explanation of why the car stopped. Now, we all know about the fact that cars, when they do get wet, don't usually start immediately, so there's a bit of a problem there, but this is only secondary compared to what one finds when he looks, as I have, at the actual weather data for the case in question.
Excuse me, sir, before we get there, if it were ball lightning, is it normal to have ball lightning of that size, and
no.
Would that ball lightning have the electromagnetic quality of stopping these engines?
Well, there are first of all, the typical size of ball lightning. Ball lightning is a fairly rare phenomenon. Most of us have never seen it. I have never seen it, though that's very much in my field. The foot in diameter is a typical phenomenon. But the cases of ball lightning that are on record are strictly limited to extreme thunderstorm conditions where you have an energy source, a high potential, high gradient. And I am not aware of any case where a vehicle was stopped by ball lightning. I could not assert that it could not occur. Well, then this was the question. I discussed this problem with a colleague at Westinghouse who's expert in these problems. He said, well, maybe in the event of a really severe thunderstorm, you could scale up ball lightning to tens of feet, and maybe they made an error of estimated size. So I looked at the map, and I was quite startled as a person with meteorological training. Here's the map for the very time. This is 12 o'clock midnight, right in the middle of the Level in Texas.
That's a weather
case.
Map.
This is a weather map. These are the isobars. I think perhaps many persons looking on will be familiar with this from weather sessions. Here's the Gulf Coast, and the state of Texas is in here. Now, I'll point with my pencil to Leveland, Texas, which is in the panhandle, and any of you who are familiar with meteorology will immediately be bothered by the fact that Leveland was being invaded by a large, high-pressure area pushing down over the Great Plains. The nearest front was down near San Angelo, hundreds of miles away. The nearest rain was about 100 miles away. The weather report for the nearest stations involved only scattered clouds, and in Leveland area, there were no stations at the time of the observation that even had any rain. Two hours later, there was one station that had less than 1/100 of an inch, and here is the official explanation, charging severe thunderstorms and wet ignitions. Utterly senseless, and when I asked the people at Wright-Patterson, they really had no very good answer, and all I can say is that in cases of this sort, an ad hoc explanation is almost pulled out of the blue. I have just seen it in too many instances to be happy with this. There are many very definite things that could be done in a scientific context to pursue this problem, and it badly needs that kind of attention, in my opinion.
Thank you very much, Professor McDonald. We'll be back again in just a moment. We have heard the extraordinary personal story of Barney and Betty Hill and a much broader discussion of the phenomenon of UFOs by a panel of authorities, some of whom insist there are no visitors from outer space, some of whom are skeptical, and some of whom believe that the only explanation to fit the facts is that there are extraterrestrial visitors. Well, what are we to believe when the experts disagree? Speaking both for myself and for the editors of this program, we would say this. Unidentified flying objects demand serious and immediate scientific attention. We would recommend, 1, an immediate study in depth by university teams. 2, a pattern analysis by computer of existing data. And 3, the establishment of a UFO research center staffed by competent scientists.
for ridicule is no longer appropriate. We did not write the words that I have just spoken. They are taken from a speech made in June of this year by Dr. J. Allen Hynek, chairman of the Astronomy Department of Northwestern University, and for the past 18 years, science advisor to the Air Force study of UFOs. We subscribe to his recommendations. But we would make one important addition, that the UFO Research Center be totally independent of government, but that it have the authority to examine Air Force data. This is David Schoenbrunn. Good night.